this episode with Nurturing Wellbeing with Kurt Kelly. I'm bringing in a good friend of mine, John Cooper, who is the CEO and president of Kids Central in the Central Florida area, but he's also the chair of the Florida Coalition for Children. During his time, we had maybe one of the most traumatic things that's happened in the United States, this pandemic. Because of that, we were able to show how we could adapt and move expeditiously to be able to change things and support children and families during this time of crisis. I think you're going to enjoy this episode. John, welcome. We're so glad you're here. I'm glad to see you in your little couch. Usually I see you in a suit and tie, but you're on a mission of mercy this week. And I want us to talk a little bit about the Pony Express and how it relates to what community-based care. I've made the argument that community-based care is strategically aligned to do things like this quicker, faster, and therefore providing better well-being for the children and families. So tell us a little bit about some of the things that, as we started developing, let our audience know a little bit about what we did over the last 18 months.
Sure. Thank you, Kurt. You know, first, let's back up. You made a comment about being faster than government. And I would tell you in the 20 years since the lead agency community-based care model has been in existence, we were well prepared for this. We manage shifting priorities year in and year out. So when the pandemic hit, that constant shifting of priorities and how nimble and agile we are really had us prepared to react and respond to something that most of us have never experienced in our lifetime.
And you know what, John? It, not only that, we were having a conversation about getting ready for this. Back in January, I think like January 30th, we actually had our first conversation saying, okay, guys, this pandemic that they're talking about is coming to the United States. We already found out it had already been here, but it was coming to the United States. Let's get ourselves prepared. I remember you led that call and we began to talk about it. And we used a term called PPE, personal protection equipment. And what was out there was being taken by the hospitals. And so John and I spent many a weekend and weeks of trying to find this PPE for our own system of care and ended up actually helping government. We ended up helping the department find the initial sourcing for a lot of this. Now, when they turn their attention, they do a great job. But you're exactly right. We were engaged in this process. And as we got it in, now the next thing is, how do you get it distributed across the system of care?
So as you mentioned, we spent a lot of time trying to source PPE all across the world, not just in the United States. And the first 21 days, we probably struck out 10 times a day. So it was very difficult just sourcing the PPE before we even began to think about distribution. But, you know, first, when it came to logistics, it made a lot of sense. As a chair of the FCC at the time, and also, you know, our headquarters is geographically in the center of the state almost, right? We're right at the confluence of the Turnpike and I-75. So we were able to use that location as a base. And we are fortunate that Kids Central has a large resource center downstairs in our building that had a ton of space available. And we didn't realize at the time, but we needed all that space. We'll talk about it in a little bit. As those shipments were coming in, they were coming in on 18-wheelers with pallets of material. Not a couple boxes at a time, hundreds, 500, 600 boxes, mask, hand sanitizer, and other PPE equipment. So, you know, we had a loading dock in the back of our building. We had a resource center. We were in the middle of the state. So logistically, it just made a lot of sense to raise my hand and volunteer. 4 months later, I may have regretted volunteering sometimes. I didn't think I'd be doing it for 4 months. But, you know, it wasn't just me. All my peers around the state volunteered to step up to create that Pony Express. And then my staff also stepped up to do the inventory, the unloading, the loading. So it was a lot of work, but we had a little bit of fun sometimes.
So the old Pony Express was that they would go from point A, go to a watering hole, then go to the next thing. And then somebody would grab hold of the mail and take it to the next point, and they'd right. do that. So that's kind of how we did this, as we went one southeast, one southwest, and one north. Correct. And then you had it set up so that when you would deliver it to one area, to Gainesville, then Gainesville would take it and deliver it over to Jacksonville and to St. Augustine, and then someone would take it to Tallahassee. Correct. And so forth. So
our southwest run was to Tampa. So that's just a little over an hour drive for us. And Tampa would receive a large quantity, sometimes massive quantities of PPE. And then Sarasota would drive to Tampa to pick up their supply. They would also take back the supply to Fort Myers for Nadere and her team. And then Nadere would drive up to Sarasota to pick up her PPE. And then Heartland, Terry and her team from Lakeland, would drive over to Tampa and pick up their PPE. So we were able to knock out five lead agencies with that Southwest run.
And so as the lead agencies get it, then they would immediately take it out and ship it out to their providers. Correct. Based upon the need and request and so forth. So in a day's time, literally in a day's time, we could reach the entire state of Florida, which was done so that we could get the necessary materials. Why? So people could go out and do their job. They could do it safely. They could have the using the social distancing, but they have the mask and the gloves and the hand sanitizers and things of that nature to be able to go out there and have that contact. And I will tell you, we didn't get a lot of credit for this, for what we did during that. That wasn't just a one-time event. It was an ongoing event. We started initially without a whole lot of help from government. And I use that from the Department of Children and Families. Now, eventually they were able to get some great resources and they would get it down to you. And so there was a great conversation. We also work with stakeholders. So we had the managing entities a lot of times, and we would take it to them, or our folks would take it and drop stuff off to them. So we worked with our stakeholders as well. And in that process, what you didn't hear is you didn't hear a lot of concerns that we weren't meeting the people's needs. We were hearing a lot about hospitals and they couldn't get it. We heard a lot about other clinics and so forth. But in our world, we went out and sourced it, found it, distributed it, and stayed on top of it to make sure that we didn't have any missing deliverable of services for children and family. And probably that's the most important thing is during all of this, John, we just didn't miss a beat, did we?
No, and Kurt, I think that's something people outside of the child protection, child welfare industry don't realize, that, you know, most of our teams, right, our staff and our frontline staff that are out there, our case managers, they are quasi first responders.
Yes.
We can't stop doing our job because of a pandemic. There were ways that we could protect our staff, but we couldn't stop what we do. So I would always argue that we are definitely first responders.
And in that first responding, we were able to accomplish all of this. And we kind of thought it was behind us. And then, of course, the variant has taken place. Quite frankly, it even may be more serious than what we originally experienced, and hits a different population. It hits closer to our population. We've seen actually more losses. I want to be sensitive to the fact that we can say all the good things, but we've seen a lot of pain in our world. You've lost a couple of folks to COVID. They were there serving children and families, and today they have a grave marker. And we're pretty sensitive about those kind of issues, but that happened across the state, which is why we felt it was important to make sure that we provide for them when it took place, this Delta variant, that we try to reinstitute some of the PPEs. Now, a lot of folks already had it. You're out here delivering right now the rapid test kits.
The COVID-19 rapid test kit.
Yeah, so people could know, and if you have a problem, and get on top of this ahead of time. I've made the argument that we're strategically positioned to do these type of things during this type of crisis. But let's talk about some other type of things that we deal with. Hurricanes come. You remember 2018 when Michael came ashore and just devastated this area up here across the state through the coalition. And I know you were there. You were there a couple of days right after the hurricane. Couldn't even get through. So you were calling me on a satellite phone, and we were talking about it. The coalition and its members were able to coalesce somewhere in the neighborhood of around $300,000 worth of goods and services that we put together to provide support for children and families so we would try not to miss a beat. Tell us a little bit about some of the things that you see that's the uniqueness of community-based care that allows us to do these type of things.
You know, it's a product of teamwork, right? A lot of us have worked together for a lot of years. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, we've all suffered some loss with COVID. So, you know, even prior to COVID, it's always that compassion, the willingness to help our peers around the state. And being a non-bureaucratic agency allows us to do that without seeking permission, going out there and helping our neighbor, helping our peer, helping another leader. And the hurricane's a great example. You talk to Mike Watkins today, he'll probably tell you they're still recovering in Circuit 14, especially around the workforce. But we were able to quickly get our leaders together and our members, not only raise money, but send staff from multiple places around the state to help Mike when a lot of his team members had to move out of the area. They had nowhere to live. So again, that ability just to come together, coalesce around the issue and work together. You know, we've done that year in and year out. And Kurt, I think we'll continue to do that. And working in an industry like child welfare, child protection, we're going to have to continue to do that.
You deployed both resources and human resources to go into an affected area, and you were able to do it quickly. And again, that stresses your own area. I mean, we still have a lot of areas that we need to cover and a lot of issues that we need to address. In fact, I'm going to talk about one here in just a second. I'm going to throw you a curveball a little bit, and I want to talk about workforce, because one of the issues that came out of COVID is this sort of a depletion of the workforce and or a changing of the workforce. And it is not lost upon us. And I know that's a major initiative of you and your team, as well as across the entire coalition and what we had at our leadership summit. Let's move into that area, the need to look at redefining and kind of reestablishing our workforce, especially our case management, as you mentioned. Let's talk a little bit about that and some of your efforts in that area.
Yeah, you know, developing workforce mitigation strategies has been a priority for, I think, every lead agency, every provider, every case management provider in the state. Historically, not just in Florida, but around the country, we are prone to high attrition rates. And I think we're always going to have some type of attrition. Mike DeBrisi says it best. It's a hard job no matter what you do, right? So it's going to continue to be a hard, demanding career. And not everyone's cut out to do it. They want to do it. They're passionate. You know, they get into it and realize, wow, this is really tough. So those are challenges we've always had. You know, the pandemic, the hurricanes, those other things we respond only exasperates the attrition that we have. And as you mentioned, currently today, myself and my peers probably have higher attrition rates than the high attrition rates that we typically experience. But to compound that situation, there are workforce shortages, not just in our industry, but across the country, across the state. You know, in the past, we would advertise a position. You may get a dozen responses. Today, we're lucky to get two. And neither one of those may be qualified.
And with the amendment two that came out with the $15 an hour minimum, which is like $31,000 a year, unfortunately, that was what is almost a starting position, maybe a little bit more than that, a starting position. So you can go work, and I know this is one of your favorite places, Chipotle, and you can go work at Chipotle for $17 an hour and say, you know, may I take your order? Or you can go out into a crisis situation, which our first responders are. That's really what they are, with all of the things that are placed upon them. And that makes it very challenging for us. So give us a little bit of ideas of what you think and how we're going to address this, because I know we've had legislators directly asking us these questions.
Well, Kurt, we started last year and then the FCC picked it up as a priority. We want to really focus on our workforce, primarily case management, but all of our workforce, our family support workers, our support staff, our group home providers, the other type of home visiting programs that we have. I think we have to look at our workforce across the board, but primarily lead agencies fund the case management piece. So that's going to be a big priority this year. We've collected data over the last 6 months. A lot of people in the national data, we know why people leave, right? It's a tough job, work-life balance, low pay, lack of progression, lack of salary progression. So those are top reasons. There are a few others. What we've tried to spend our time on the last 6 months is look at people that have been in the profession for 2 to 3 years, why do they stay? What is that character profile, those attributes around the people that stay, and really focus on building a profile on the people that actually remain in the job, regardless of the pandemic, regardless of a hurricane. We have people that have been committed to what they do, and they have longevity. So we're really focusing on that population, building that profile. We've engaged Florida State University, Dr. Darren Brooks, and one of his partners. He's also the executive director of the HR Center at the School of Business, and using some modeling and work that they've done in the past, really helping us to define the profile, help us build a better selection criteria, better interviewing guides, better hiring practices, but also really focus on retention strategies. That's a lot of work. We're into it a couple months. We have multiple partners around the state, including some providers, Camelot, Gulf Coast Services, Northwest Health. They're all involved. It's probably a few months out before we have the final recommendations, but I can tell you a big focus is on increasing the salaries of our staff, but not only increasing the salaries, giving them the opportunity for financial progression so they can make a career out of this job.
An upward mobility aspect into this process, which really hadn't been there. And I think it's either you're a case manager or you're a supervisor, or you're out, you know, and that's we need to, I think this is brilliant.
If you go back to an OPAGA study, I'm just going to guess around 2017, maybe 16, 18, the average case manager salary was $37,000. 7 years later, the average case manager salary is $37,000.
Yeah.
So that tells it all right there. We definitely need to increase the starting salary, but also offer people opportunities to have that salary progression remain in the job.
And the reason we camp around case management, it is such a critical component to what we do making sure that all of the rules, regulations, laws, aspects that are put on child welfare, that they are actually being adhered to, and that they really have somebody that's sort of their concierge that's taking care of the child. And when you have a 20-to-1 case ratio, it becomes paper shufflers. And I think that's where a lot of the job dissatisfaction takes place. And so I think that you are really onto something. I remember, was it the CWLA came out 15 years ago that said the optimum number is a 12-to-1 ratio of cases to a caseworker. Probably with the acuity level that we're seeing now of some of the kids coming in, it may be lower than that. And yet we're still hovering around that 18%, 18 to 18 and a half. And so I know that this is a big initiative that the Florida Coalition for Children is engaging. I can tell you that I have folks from all over the United States that are going to be watching where we go with this. I have key members of the legislature that have been on Nurturing Wellbeing with Kurt Kelly have told us we got to deal with this year.
So Kurt, you already know it's a big ticket, right?
It's a big ticket.
Yep. We've done the initial analysis. We have a projected dollar amount it would take to increase the base salary and offer that salary progression for a series of workers, including our supervisors in the front line. And it's almost $25 million to make that happen.
Just that portion.
Now,
if you look at all across the other system, all the other areas, we also have another workforce that we have to deal with.
And I would argue there, Kurt, we have a little more control over that. Mm-hmm. We don't directly pay for that out of the contracts. Those are through rate agreements.
Right.
So our home visitors, our residential group care providers, we can always negotiate rates and create rate setting to allow them to give their staff well-deserved increases also. But to do that, Kurt, we still need additional funding from a lead agency to make those appropriate adjustments to those contracts.
I think we've seen the legislature, and they're great partners of ours, and that's why we talk about partnership. I think it's important for us to remind them of the unique things that we can do and have done in Florida with like this malleable aspect of being able to move expeditiously, quickly to respond to crisis needs and working collaboratively and not waiting on things to happen. We can be proactive in that. But we also need to have those partners understand that we're not immune to all of the issues that are facing a lot of the workforce out there. And we have got to address that this coming year. So I'm excited. First of all, thank you for your vision. You had foresight to say this is a critical component. I know many of our providers are very thankful for this. We have multiple issues that we have to address. And in this area, this would be one key area that helps us be able then to do more than just child welfare, but to nurture that well-being. In other words, that's why I say we're strategically aligned and set up to be able to do some of the prevention, intervention, and diversion services that the federal government's wanting us to do. I think Florida's going to be in a position to really do a great job.
Florida was already well-positioned for FFPSA. With the Title IV waiver that we had for almost 20 years, it really allowed us to shift our attention upstream, be creative with our federal funding, and allow us to use it for things not included in traditional foster care. So we were probably better positioned for FFPSA than any other state in the country.
As we close out today, and thank you for coming to the studio. Thank you for your mission of mercy up here to North Florida and getting the tests out. And I know you've already got them already spread out across the rest of the state already. And there'll be more. We've got more to do in this area. Hopefully this little uptick in what we're seeing with the variant is going to begin to subside a little bit, hopefully here in the next couple of weeks. And then there's, who knows, there may be something else. But just thank you for being the chair of the coalition. You and Elizabeth Winter, who's the chair of the foundation, you two took your jobs basically in December of 2019. And here we are in 2020, January. And your whole time has been through this. We had to cancel meetings, that everything became virtual. And yet the work of child welfare and child well-being continued. I'd say we actually got stronger through this process, and a lot's attributed to your leadership. And I don't just say that because you're my boss, but I also say that because you you did show great leadership. You and Elizabeth Winter, Dr. Winter, with the foundation has been really adaptable, and you've done some amazing things. And I can tell you that I believe the coalition is stronger because of that. We look forward to moving out of this and getting back to, if there's anything that's called normal in child welfare, getting back to that. But if not, I think we'll continue to show the taxpayers, our stakeholders at the Capitol, the governor's office, Department of Children and Families, that our system of care is strong because it is community-based. And I just think that's a strength.
Yeah, thank you, Kurt. And that community-based model, I have a saying, some people think I made it up. I've heard it or I read it. I don't know where it came from, but there's no finish line in child welfare, right? You've heard me say that over and over again. We don't score a touchdown and claim victory. Our job's ongoing, and it always will be, and we need to recognize that, and I think our model does. Our peers around the state understand that, and we operate in that model, and our goal is just to continue to function regardless of a pandemic, regardless of a hurricane. And, you know, we do that with compassion. We do that because we know, regardless of what's happening out there, there's families and kids out there that need our help, and we're always going to respond.
And in this compassion business, it's done professionally and it's done the right way. And that's why this conversation today is so important for folks across the United States and even internationally, quite frankly, now, that they understand that Florida is uniquely positioned and we make the most of that opportunity when it's availed to us. And so I'm very, very thankful. Thank you for your leadership. I can tell you that where we're going in the future, some of the creative and innovative, it's the secret sauce of community-based cares is the innovation. You and I have said that. Yep. And by the way, I do attribute that line to you that there is no finish line. And we know that we continually improve. And I think that's one of the strengths of our community-based care model. With that, thank you for being with our program today. And we look forward to having you in the future.
Thank you, Kurt.
God bless. Nurturing well-being is more than just a group of folks getting together and trying to think of how to provide services. It is truly engaging our children, our families, our communities, and trying to do all the right things for them. And I think this episode has shown you how we can adapt quickly and to really meet the needs of our citizens. It was an honor to have John Cooper on the show today. I hope you enjoyed. Thanks to your support, we can continue to engage with those who serve the children of Florida and continue our mission to support Florida's families. Listen and subscribe to Nurturing Wellbeing with Kurt Kelly for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you prefer to get your podcasts. You can rate and review. We'd appreciate you giving us a 5.